this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
It was a proxy war of influence between the French and the Americans, and between the French and the British, and basically the puppets of the U.S. and the U.K., Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni, ended up winning. They won on the heels of that genocide that took hundreds of thousands of lives in the space of 3 months.
Human rights activist Claude Gatabuki reflects on the genocide in Rwanda 30 years later.
Texas is now trying to engage in immigration enforcement under the guise of doing it under criminal punishment enforcement.
Should Texas have authorization to enforce federal immigration laws?
If the union is willing to use members' dues to shut down a Teamster free speech website, we cannot match those resources.
Teamster president Sean O'Brien uses a union-busting firm to shut down a rank-and-file website.
The results of the local elections held on March 31st show that the people of the country are ready for change.
Turkish people vote for the opposition to the ruling party in local elections. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. The Rwandan genocide occurred between April 7th through July 15th, 1994, during the Rwandan Civil War. In this 100-day period, an estimated 500,000 to 1 million Rwandans were killed as UN peacekeepers stood by. On April 6, 1994, Paul Kagame, now the current president of Rwanda, reportedly ordered the shooting down of Rwanda's presidential plane, killing two presidents and everyone on board. That was the opening act in the Rwanda genocide. Kagame and his Rwandan Patriotic Front regime had military and financial support from the U.S., the U.K., and the EU. Rwanda genocide survivor and human rights activist Claude Gatabuki recalls the horror and deadly massacre in Kigali 30 years ago while fleeing for his life alongside his mother. And what do we know about the current genocide that's unfolding in the Congo, reportedly perpetrated by Rwanda and Uganda with the full support of the U.S., EU, Canada, and Israel? Here's Gatabuki speaking to Block Report radio host J.R. Valray.
Claude Gatabuki is no stranger to the Block Report. He is a human rights activist with the African Great Lakes Action Network, and he is also the co-author of Survivors Uncensored, 100 Testimonies from the Rwandan Genocide. Claude, you recently brought to my attention that this year is the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan Genocide. Many of us have seen it in Hollywood movies, but you were somebody who was there. Can you give the people a brief history of what exactly happened? What are the names of the players involved? And what has the effect been on your life personally, as well as the country?
Thank you so much for bringing this important conversation forward, and especially the importance of who the players were and who they are today and how it ties to us here in America. So the genocide itself 30 years ago, when it happened, I was 14 years old. And at the time, Rwanda was in the middle of a war, a four-year war that started in Uganda, started by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who sponsored current Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, and his group of rebels, the RPF, who attacked Rwanda, committed atrocities, massacres all over the northern part of Rwanda, and displaced over 1 million people. And to put that in perspective, that would be like taking more than 30 million Americans and displacing them in the space of 3 years. That war had gone on for three and a half years. That would be like taking every black person in America and displacing them, basically, if I can put it that way. It was that much of the population. And me personally, when the genocide started, we were attacked. Gangs and militias who were wreaking havoc and killing indiscriminately, killing people all over the place with hand weapons machetes came to search for us as we were hiding. They searched the house. They didn't find us. We ended up fleeing our house. We fled the city that I grew up in, the city of Kigali. And while we were fleeing, I was actually stopped with my mother, and we were made to dig our own grave. We did not, we only survived because of strangers, people in the area who rushed in and started yelling and pleading for us. And then two men who were brought by a driver who was transporting us from the city of Kigali to the western part of Rwanda, actually, they pleaded for us until one of them said, you know, this boy and his mom are not going to make it 5 miles from here. Why don't you let somebody else kill them? That was one of the experiences. But we had many, many near-death experiences during that genocide. And my story came after, as I said, over a million people had already fled the RPF led by Paul Kagame, who were also committing major massacres, rounding people up by the hundreds, sometimes by the thousands, surrounding them and shooting them and throwing grenades into crowds and then finishing them off with hand weapons. These were horror scenes. And this was not a movie. These were real. This was reality. And the players, of course, at the time, there was Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni who were teaming up, and they had this rebellion, this rebel group that was made of mostly people of Tutsi ethnicity who came in from Uganda with the support of the U.S. and the U.K., fighting Rwanda's government at the time that were predominantly of Hutu ethnicity. And that government was supported by the French. And so it was a fight, a proxy war of influence between the French and the Americans and between the French and the British. And what ended up happening was basically the puppets of the U.S. and the U.K., Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni, ended up winning. And when they won on the heels of that genocide that took hundreds of thousands of lives in the space of 3 months. Bodies were piled up on the streets. The stench in the street, I mean, it stunk really bad. But it didn't stop there. The game is still going, as, you know, many have capitalized on actually all those lives lost and the riches of the region. This genocide and that war didn't just happen out of the blue. It wasn't, though nobody take it as this was tribal war as often is depicted about Africans. This was a war for resources. Obviously now the French and the Americans and the whole European Union, the UK, the whole Western world, Canada, especially Canada, have all teamed up on plundering with their multinational companies taking part in the plundering of the resources of the region, especially in the Congo. So what happened was the war didn't stop in Rwanda. It didn't even stop with the genocide in Rwanda. What happened, the genocide ended by the RPF winning the war. But then the RPF continued their genocidal pursuits, went into the Congo. They went after more than a million refugees who had fled the war into the Congo. They massacred those refugees. They marched across the Congo, and they helped to install another puppet, a president into the Congo. And the whole region basically became a plunder happy.
Who was that leader?
The leader was Laurent Kabila. And after a few years of installing him in the Congo, he turned on them and said, no, I don't want you to continue to plunder the riches of the Congo. I don't want you to make us puppets of yours. And he was assassinated. By the way, the spark to the Rwandan genocide was an assassination of two presidents. The Burundian and the Rwandan presidents in 1994 were shot in their plane. They were on the plane on the returning to Rwanda from Tanzania. And what I know now, you mentioned the book Survivors Uncensored. Actually, one of the testimonies that's in there is from Paul Kagame's own bodyguards, former bodyguards, who testified directly to me and told me that one of them was in a meeting to plan where they planned the shooting of the plane. The other one also had knowledge of Paul Kagame ordering the shooting of the plane. That shooting of the plane started the genocide. So when Laurent Kabila was assassinated, he was the third president assassinated in a period of less than 5 years. And the massacres of civilians and innocent people didn't stop. Rwanda and Uganda, with the help of the U.S. and the U.K. especially, and now in current day with the European Union also, they invaded the Congo multiple times, killed millions of Congolese people, and plundered billions worth of minerals out of the Congo. The coltan that is found in our phones, the lithium that's used today in
electric vehicles, yeah.
Yes. The gold, timber, all kinds of resources have been plundered out of the Congo. They have been transited through Rwanda and Uganda. And the UN has had a supposed to be a peacekeeping mission for more than 20 years, is financed with over $1 billion a year, and they have not done anything to actually bring about peace in that region, because having peace in that region would actually stop the plunder. And if it stopped the plunder, it would impact the multinationals. There are a lot of companies on the Toronto stock market, Canada, a country that's known as the polite and nice country that is neighbors with the U.S. Their companies are some of the leading companies in the destruction of the Congo. There are American companies, European companies.
Let's name some of those. Who are some of the companies? Who are some of the main culprits that are raping the coltan and the gold and many other mineral resources out of the Congo?
I'll name a couple. It's Banro. There is AngloGold, Ashanti, and there's especially Glencore, owned by an Israeli, Dan Gertler, who is on a sanctions list, whose company has been one of the leading plunderers of the Congo. And Glencore is one of the most egregious companies that's been causing havoc in the Congo. So the legacy of the genocide, where we started, the genocide that happened 30 years ago, on the heels of a four-year brutal, bloody war that included massacres of innocent people for no reason, on the heels of, by the way, the group that invaded Rwanda was also involved in massacres of Ugandan people in Uganda before 1990 when they invaded Rwanda. So it's still ongoing today. And what we have today is a disguise. Now, what is happening is Rwanda and Uganda, they no longer invade the Congo openly, because there's a lot of awareness around the world about what's happening in the Congo. The rising awareness is preventing them from doing it openly. And what's happening is they have been using proxy, or they have been setting up the so-called rebel groups. But these aren't rebel groups. These are national militaries of Rwanda and Uganda that are in the Congo, fighting in the Congo. And who finances them? What does that have to do with us in America? The U.S. tax dollars are actually footing the bill to support those two regimes in East Central Africa, in Uganda and in Rwanda. Both, they receive aid, and they're receiving American taxpayers' money. On top of that, they receive military training and all kinds of support. In recent times, there's been a rise of awareness of America's involvement, just like there has been a rise of awareness in America's involvement, not only in the genocide in Congo, but also especially in Israel, but also in the genocide in Congo. U.S. officials have been denying that they are involved with Rwanda's invasion of the Congo, and on the other hand, continuing to support Rwanda's government with aid money, economic support, and military support. So that is, in a nutshell, the kind of the summary of the situation. What we have today, though, is what is called a so-called M23 rebellion in the Congo. But what it is actually Rwanda's and Uganda's militaries invading the Congo. And who supports it? It's especially the U.S. and the U.K. and the European Union. Now, I would be remiss not to use this analogy. What is happening in the Congo is similar to what happened during the transatlantic slave trade. During the transatlantic slave trade, you had corporations. You had resources. The resources were us, the human beings. And then you had corporations that were plundering resources, us, the human beings. They were going out there, kidnapping and taking people and selling people for profit. They needed governments to protect them, to create laws and to legalize it, to make it legal. They also needed local collaborators, the local sellouts, to work with them. That is exactly what we have in the Congo and in Central Africa. You have global institutions like the UN, like the World Bank, like the International Monetary Fund, all aligned with the Paul Kagame's and the Yoweri Museveni's, oh, by the way, with also the US and the UK and the Canada and the European Union, all of them align with the local sellouts, the Paul Kagame's and the Yoweri Museveni's, who are involved in the massacres of millions of people, who are selling the people out, who are selling the resources out of the region. The corporations are making a profit, and the institutions and government are giving them cover. And I'd be remiss not to use that analogy.
What is it that people can do that are listening to this broadcast?
One of the things that is really important, I know there are a lot of people who are skeptical, but speaking up and speaking out and really making it clear, using every platform that you have to speak out and saying, not on my watch, not on my dollar, will there be genocide. Not in the Congo, not in Israel, not any other part of the world. I think it's important for the listeners to make it known to their leaders, to everyone that's complicit in the massacres, in this genocide in the Congo, which that would be their Congress people, that would be the leaders in the U.S., the government leaders in the U.S., to make sure that they know, that the people do know. Because one thing that I've seen in recent times, all of these U.S. officials at the U.N., the ambassadors and so many others who are denying U.S. involvement in the Congo, is they're doing it because the world has turned up the heat and is showing. You know, people are protesting in places like London and Paris and Washington, D.C., and in various African cities against not only the killings of the people in the Congo, but against the involvement of these Western puppet masters that are causing and sponsoring all of the havoc. I've seen where people have burnt U.S. flags at those protests, and that's what's prompted the U.S. government's officials to actually start denying that they're involved with Rwanda's invasion of the Congo. So when American people actually start now speaking out even more about it, because who's speaking out right now are people around the world. When American people start speaking up about it, the heat is going to turn up even more. So use every platform possible, speak up on it. Share this type of broadcast, this information, make sure it is known. Look up Congo genocide, that hashtag, or the hashtag Rwanda is killing, and follow what is going on and share and make sure that everyone is aware, not only your community, but also officials in the U.S. government, that they know that you are speaking out and saying, don't use my money to kill people. Don't use my money to sponsor mass murderers and genocidaires.
That was Rwandan genocide survivor and human rights activist Claude Gatabuke speaking with Block Report radio host J.R. Valray.
Mama, I'm coming to you.
was Rwanda vocalist and musician Cecile Kariwebwa Tarienda. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Rates, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Why is Texas fighting for full control of federal immigration law enforcement at the border and throughout the state? The Texas immigration law known as SB4 is on hold from being enforced after the Supreme Court gave it a green light. Nana Jamfi, attorney and executive director at Black Alliance for Just Immigration, explains why the border crisis has become controversial and sheds light on the debate over its legality playing out in a lower court of appeals.
Can you help us understand the
framework of SB4?
Thank you so very much, Akua. I really appreciate you having me on to talk about this issue. It is a critical issue for a lot of communities outside of just migrants. In order to see that, I think people need to look at this from the perspective of what this is, which is a bill about criminal punishment system law enforcement. That is the realm in which this bill exists. Texas, though it tries very hard, is not able to do immigration enforcement. That is a federal law. And so who is being given the tools now through SB4 to stop folks, to frisk folks, to search folks, to, you know, harass people in the ways that we know law enforcement does, is any Texas law enforcement agency, right? Or a law enforcement agent, which includes police, includes sheriffs, includes state police. They've even included the parks and recreation police, like anyone who can say that they are law enforcement in the state of Texas that are not federal law enforcement, has the power now to stop people that they believe may not be from the United States, begin to interrogate them. And so it's not just at the border. It is throughout the state of Texas, which is very important. It doesn't stop anyone from coming across the border. What it does do is give law enforcement one more tool in their toolbox to engage in the type of racial profiling that we know too often ends in the death of Black and Brown folks, regardless of citizenship in the state of Texas and across the country.
And you said regardless of citizenship. Explain what you mean when you say that.
But, you know, people have this notion that there's some kind of, I don't know, halo or something or glow that you have when you are a citizen of this country that's going to make it clear that you are a citizen versus someone else who is not, right? And so, and that's not true. And we know that's not true. Just from our own experiences, when people see me, they don't know my name. They just see me walking and driving. They have no idea that I have a Ghanaian lineage, right? Now, I was born in this country, so I am a citizen, but there's no way to tell that. There's no way to tell the difference between me and you as we are walking down the street, as we are driving. And so this gives, again, another opportunity for the law enforcement to do that stop. Maybe it's not the taillight this time. It's not the Christmas tree, you know, smelling ornament on the back, the window, back view mirror. Instead, what it is, I was looking at you and you looked like you might be from Nigeria or Ghana or Jamaica. And we know we come in all kinds of complexions, all kind of hair textures. So if you're thinking you're looking like Meghan Markle, it can't be you. Please disabuse yourself of that. It can be you, because people from other countries that are Black and Brown have all kinds of complexions, all kinds of phenotypes. And again, this just becomes another tool for racial profiling, racial harassment, further arrest, imprisonment, assault, and unfortunately, death.
Well, the Biden administration sued the state of Texas shortly after Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed SB4 into law in December of 2023 and argued that the law is an overreach and conflicts with the federal government's authority to enforce immigration laws. There was a seesaw thing going on with the courts because, again, Texas plans were to put on hold after setting off uncertainty over the border and that late night ruling that I mentioned on March 19th. An appeals court panel temporarily put SB4 on hold. And that was after the U.S. Supreme Court had cleared the way for the strict immigration law, giving Abbott a victory for a couple of hours. And then later that 2-1 ruling said, no, let's put this on hold ahead of the oral arguments for or against SB4. How do you think this is going to play out in federal court?
It's going to be very interesting. I mean, my sense is we want to say that how it's going to play out is that the Supreme Court is going to see that there is an infringement here on the federal ability to control what is, in fact, immigration. Now, there's different parts to this bill. There's a part of the bill, or, you know, that was basically passed into law at this point, even though it's being held, it is the law in Texas. There's a part to the law that says that people who are convicted through the criminal punishment system process of being in Texas without having been inspected at the border are going to be sent back to Mexico. That part, I think the court would definitely say no to, because now we're talking about international law, you know, international policy. Now you got to have a conversation with AMLO and Mexico and see what you can do over there. So that is clearly something that I think the courts are going to say, even based on some of the rulings they've held with Remain in Mexico, et cetera, that, hey, once you start getting into the foreign policy realm, you've gone too far. Now, in terms of the internal part, that issue, I think, is a little hairier. Now, I think legal wise, you know, based upon what the law says, that Texas should lose, because Texas is now trying to engage in immigration enforcement under the guise of doing it under criminal punishment enforcement. But we do have a 6-3 Supreme Court, and we have those six are pretty conservative, some extreme conservative. And so there's always cause for pause when we look at what the Supreme Court might do in this scenario and how much they may try to overreach themselves to be able to get to the conclusion that they want to get to in favor of Texas, if that's where the six are looking.
It seems as though if they give Texas a win, then other states will follow suit, enforcing what was once a federal responsibility, immigration. That seems like it's going to be chaotic to states having their own interpretation of what was once federal law, if the court says, okay, Texas, you can now handle your immigration problems at the border, and we will tell the feds to back off.
Yes, I mean, it would be chaotic. And again, it wouldn't just be handle your immigration problems at the border. It would be handle immigration throughout the state of Texas, right? Which is still an immigration issue that falls under the feds and not falling under the state. I don't think that the courts will find at the end of the day that they're going to give Texas that much power. That would, you know, the Fifth Circuit, all of those states, Louisiana, everybody would jump into it and make it their business to also, even though they're not at a border, still engage in this type of lawmaking. We know that Florida has already tried to enter into the realm using this criminal enforcement space to try to engage in immigration enforcement. And we know that other states have lined up policies to do the same thing. I agree with you that the Supreme Court, really, those justices have to think long and hard about how far into this game they want to play if they decide that they want to give a nod to Abbott and Texas in this situation. They may, as they used to do, if you recall, when, you know, Donald Trump, when they would have him lose, they would kind of give him the prescription to make it okay so that he could do sort of what he wanted to do. And so that's another option in this case, in which they reject Texas. But in the opinion, as they're rejecting Texas, they provide some description of how this or something similar could be done that may not violate the Fed. So we'll see.
Okay. And Leslie, talk to us about the people at the border, the families that are there. Where are they from? But the way the story is framed, all these people are trying to get into our country from Mexico. We've had conversations, and you've mentioned that these families are from all over the world.
They are literally from all over the world. You have people that are coming in from the Caribbean. We know about the Haitians, but there are also people coming from Jamaica, people coming from Trinidad. We have people that are coming from all over the continent, people coming from places that maybe people aren't used to even hearing about, such as Mauritania, such as Mali, such as Chad, as well as places that people are more used to, such as Cameroon and Congo, Ghana, Nigeria. Senegal is another country where we see a great uptick in folks that are coming. But you have people that are coming from Asia, that are coming from Nepal, that are coming from India, that are coming from Pakistan. You have people that are coming from China, we're understanding. now we're seeing more people that are coming from China that are making that trek and coming up through South America and Central America up through Mexico to the border. So there are people that are coming from everywhere, making the effort to come and be in this country that says, has signed on to international covenants, that has made it a part of U.S. law, that it is a country where people can come and seek refuge and seek asylum. And so people are taking the United States up on its word. It really is more than unfortunate. It is tragic. It is violative of human rights law and of U.S. asylum law. The degree to which this country has made it so difficult for people to access the asylum system and the asylum process. And then on top of that, you have states like Texas making it even more difficult, whether it be by physical boundaries and barbed wire, or whether it be by laws such as SB 4.
All right. Well, I think we're going to have to change the name of this song by Irvin Berlin. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. I'm not sure if that's true anymore.
Absolutely. There are some people that are granted that red carpet. We know what happened, for example, with Ukrainians, and they were able to come across the border, fly into Mexico, literally on planes, fly into Tijuana and walk across a red carpet in a lane that was open for them to be able to come through when Title 42 still existed, while everyone else, you know, folks of color were still standing at the fences, hoping to be able to get in. And so we know who is allowed to come in and who are the poor and who are the tired and who are those fleeing war and calamity and political persecution and other forms of persecution that this country is opening its arms for and who is not. Again, this law in particular, SB 4, is really dangerous in its ability to not just cover those folks, but it's almost like Abbott said, hold my beer. I got some other folks that we can cover who, you know, may be citizens of this country, but that I still consider to be a menace. And that is what SB 4 does. It focuses, and the language is on migration, but it's using the criminal punishment system, law enforcement, in order to engage in racial profiling. And that covers all of us who are racially profiled by law enforcement in Texas.
That was Nana Jumphrey, attorney and executive director of Black Alliance for Just Immigration. According to the CPB, in January 2024, the U.S. Border Patrol recorded about 124,000 encounters between ports of entry along the southwest border, a decrease of 50% from December 2023. CPB's total encounters along the southwest border in January 2024 were about 176,000, a decrease of 42% from December 2023.
I work on the border. I see what I see. I work on the border, and it's working on me. I lie awake at night, knowing what I know. There's a price on the head of every border patrol, where the smugglers do business. That's where I make a stand. I know this old desert like the back of my hand. I see greed in the bushes. I see snakes in the dark. Some are friends of my brothers. Can't you hear them dogs bark? I come home to Maria at the end of the day, in the shape of a shadow, holding demons at bay. It's just the border, they say.
That was music by Willie Nelson, The Border. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. International Brotherhood of Teamsters President Sean O'Brien has used a union-busting law firm, Nixon Peabody, to shut down a rank-and-file website, Teamsters Link. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with retired IBT 206 Teamster Tom Leadham, who manages the website.
About a year ago, myself, Bill Zimmerman, Tim Sylvester, longtime Teamster reformers, officers, all of us have been officers for many years. We set up a website forum, an open forum, and the idea was just to give members an opportunity to voice their opinion on whatever subject related to the Teamsters it might be. And we don't, you know, we don't care if they're far left or far right, if they're Teamsters and they have ideas and they have opinions. This is a forum for them to express those views. And we started, like I say, about a year ago, a little over a year. And we slowly, you know, started to gain traction and got more members involved. And as we went, members were posting about, you know, various controversies in the union. The UPS contract campaign was a big topic. But there were a lot of things, a lot of situations in the union that members wanted to expose what's happening. And for example, when the International took credit, when Sean O'Brien took credit for organizing 206,000 new members into the Teamsters, we thought, wait a minute, that just doesn't make sense. And we did a thorough analysis of those numbers and found that it wasn't 206,000 new members. It was more like 250 new members. So we did an expose report on that. And in fact, they were forced to, the International was forced to revise their LM2s to reflect the accurate numbers. Additionally, there were other issues that came up. You know, various contract campaigns, situations, for example, where the International had made a settlement of a race discrimination case costing the union $2.9 million. We talked about that on the site. And people, it was just open. You know, people could talk about whatever they wanted to, as long as it was related to the Teamsters. We also set some pretty, I think, some pretty good rules on how people would, you know, communicate on the site and so forth. And while a lot of people thought, well, it's you can register anonymously. You know, people don't know who's there. That's actually been a real benefit, because in the Teamsters right now, retaliation is fast and furious. So to have a place where people could anonymously post information without fear of retaliation was extremely important, and it was a really popular concept. And over the last year, we've continued to grow and grow. And finally, around toward the end of January, we received a letter from Fred Zuckerman, the General Secretary Treasurer, claiming that we were in violation of their trademark rights. There was a cease and desist letter to stop Teamster Link. And I have to say, when we got the first letter from Zuckerman, we took it seriously, but we were aware that this had been happening for a long time, that local unions get the same letter when they modify the logo or when they modify the trademark in any way. And so we thought it's just a normal thing, because we'd seen that before as officers of the union. But then when we got a letter from Nixon Peabody, this notoriously anti-union law firm, they literally brag about their union avoidance programs on their website. And some of the unions that they've challenged are actually the Teamsters. And we got a letter from them on behalf of the International, threatening lawsuits and demanding that we cease and desist and take our site down. Well, we took that very seriously, because if the union is willing to use members' dues to shut down a Teamster free speech website, we cannot match those resources. So when we got that letter from Nixon Peabody, we decided we better go to a plan B. And we started developing tunionlink.org as a new site to take the place of Teamster Link. So it's t-unionlink.org. And we started building that. And we got a second letter from Nixon Peabody, and they told us that they would be sending us an agreement that would resolve the matter. Now, we knew that any document that came from these union busters was not going to be something that we could agree to. So we began to really pour it on and work hard to get a new site in place. And it's a good thing we did, because while they were claiming that they were going to send us an agreement, they weren't doing that at all. What they were doing was they had four other lawyers from the firm going to Apple to try to get them to take down our app. They did the same with Google. And they went to Facebook, and Facebook removed our Facebook page. Now, we were fairly new to Facebook. We only had about 1,200 followers. We were just getting started, so it wasn't that big a deal. But we were shocked at their ability to just close down a Facebook page, and that's what they did. So we had talked to three lawyers, and so we knew that we were on solid ground as far as our case. But the fact is, they all told us, you've got a winning case, but it's going to cost you a minimum of $100,000 to litigate it. And clearly, we're three retirees. We don't have those kind of resources. So we put T-UnionLink in place, and we were able to do that just prior to them getting an injunction to shut us down, which they were unable to do. So we moved everything over to T-UnionLink. And I have to say, since then, and since this whole controversy has started, our membership has really grown dramatically. This is an important place for Teamsters to communicate with each other. We think it should be that there should be sites like this, forum sites, open forum sites like this in every labor union. Without it, there's really no way to voice an opinion, to respond to the officers, to respond to policy. So this has been a really an important site, and it continues to grow.
This issue of, I mean, the union busting law firm has actually been used against the Teamsters in Teamster organizing. The idea that you would hire a union busting law firm, and also that's now combined with what's gone on with the IBT and Sean O'Brien inviting Donald Trump to their Teamster headquarters, where he gave a press conference attacking, bashing immigrants in the lobby of the Teamsters, and voting to give $45,000 to the Republican National Committee, which apparently is now going to be used for Donald Trump's legal fees. What does that say to Teamsters about what is going on in this union? I mean, it seems that the rise of fascism, particularly in this country, the dangers, the racism, racist attacks, the attacks against immigrants, to have any support for somebody who espouses that raises real questions about where the Teamsters are going. Are you concerned about that, Tom?
Well, I'm very concerned about it. In regard to Sean O'Brien in Mar-a-Lago, I just think that's a total embarrassment to the Teamsters, I think to the entire labor movement. There's no doubt that we have a large percentage of union members that support Trump. And clearly that's their right to do so. When you look at labor issues, though, if you look at just exclusively on labor issues, I don't think anyone would say that Trump has been pro-union ever in his existence. Has he been pro-union? And we have a responsibility to educate members on who helps unions and who hurts unions. We can't just govern our union by Gallup poll. That doesn't work. We have a responsibility where, as officers of the union, we know who operates in our best interest, which of the candidates is it operating in our best interest. And that's what we need to focus on. And we need to make sure that every union member, every Teamster knows who's on our side and who isn't.
And the invite by Labor Notes and TDU to go at the Labor Notes convention, there are probably going to be 4,500, maybe 5,000 trade union activists from around the country and internationally. Sean O'Brien has been invited to speak at that conference, at the TDU, and also to come to the Labor Notes convention. What does that say about Labor Notes? It seems like, are they listening to what's going on? Are they paying attention to what Sean O'Brien is doing in relationship to Trump, in relationship to hiring this union busting law firm?
Yeah, if I might say, this is to me is the biggest disappointment throughout all of this, is how easily it's been for Sean O'Brien to morph into a reformer. I mean, with a long history, I just don't understand how the left media, the media in general, but the left media in particular, which knows better, has just ignored his history and has ignored the current developments. There's absolutely no critical thinking on the left in regard to what's happening at the Teamsters at all. No one questions anything.
That was Teamster Local 206 leader Tom Leadham speaking with Pacificus D. Zeltzer. Important local elections were held in Turkey on March 31st. Pacifica's Mehmet Bayram reports.
Significant changes appear on the horizon after local elections in Turkey. However, will fascism allow real change? The results of the local elections held on March 31st show that the people of the country are ready for change. The country has been under the pro-Western, pro-capitalist, pro-Islamic AKP government for the last 22 years. In an unprecedented show of support for the opposition, people have mandated that this regime of privatization, Islamization, dictatorship, and unbelievable levels of corruption and cronyism must change. The cost of this integration to imperialism and the expensive loans from the Arab countries have drained the working classes and brought the country to an unsustainable level. As the saying in Turkish goes, the knife has cut through the meat and is now cutting through the bone. The government party, AKP, was shooting to get back the three largest metropolitan cities from the opposition. These cities are the bread and butter for the Erdogan government's corrupt dealings and illegal operations. The contractors, drug dealers, real estate mafia, street gangs, human traffickers, arms merchants, secret international deal brokers, mafia operations posing as touristic establishments, money laundering venues doing business as nightclubs, and many more illicit operations in these large cities are needed to maintain this fascist regime that has ruled under Islamic norms for the last 22 years. All these operations pay a cut to the governing AKP and its junior coalition, neo-Nazi MHP party. Erdogan's governing party lost big time in these cities. Working classes there, where most of the production of the country is situated, have reacted to the unbearable living conditions, lack of democracy at all levels of their lives, and attacks on any resistance against Islamic fascism, like their unionization drives. This result in the large cities was expected. However, what emerged was more than a surprise. In most regions where the liberal, nationalistic, secularist opposition CHP party has never won a single election since its one-party years of the 1940s, the people voted them in. Even in the most intense religious sect cities in the east, the central government party Erdogan's AKP lost. The neo-Nazi junior coalition party became a negligible addendum, securing less than 5% of votes. What is surprising is that this turn happened only about 10 months after the general elections, when the Islamic party and its neo-Nazi coalition partner won. Even in last year's elections, it was apparent that the government had committed colossal vote manipulations and fraud. However, this rapid change was a surprise to all observers. While the entire country is at open bankruptcy, the section of the population that brought down the corrupt Islamic votes was mostly the retirees. The retirees have not only lived under the poverty level for a long time, but in recent years, their income shows they have been living even below the hunger level. Although they have not dared to show their anger as expected on the streets, their traditional support for the conservative government changed drastically. Knowing the power of the retirees' votes, Erdogan reportedly kept asking his economics minister what could be done to increase the income of retirees facing above 140% real inflation. However, the retirees had to be pushed under the bus, because Mehmet Şimşek, the economy minister, reported back that there was nothing that could be done because there was nothing to give, Plus, the due date for those United Arab Emirates loans was approaching soon with nothing on hand to pay them back with. This openly meant that AKP accepted a defeat with a knockdown punch delivered by the retirees. That was the main reason AKP lost 4.2 million votes in the last 10 months in a country of 82 million. But it had no choice. The Islam and the racist fascists had come to the end of their rope. The Islamic fascism only bought time with foreign loans, asset sellouts, and foreign rapacious so-called investments. But the bills are due just at the same time as the elections. This caused the suicide of the government. The results sent shivers of excitement in the opposition community. Was the tide turning? Was democracy finally on the horizon for the people of Turkey? We think this is an initial step in the right direction. However, it's very early to expect this momentum to continue to the result of salvation, whatever that may mean. Turkey has lived under fascism for most of its existence. Turkey is a neo-colonial country, tied and dependent on imperialism, and its woes do not stem from local mismanagement alone. Turkey toes the line of its imperial bosses and knows the consequences it will face if it parts from the lifeline its ruling classes feed on, namely the trade pacts, NATO, and other military privileges that mutually benefit the ruling classes of both parties. Elections are only a show in fake democracies. The deep state structure established by NATO in the country's infancy is still a place and very active. The actual rise in widespread opposition will be organized at the poll stations and on the streets. Very conservative workers are discovering that the only way to get their months of past salaries paid is by stopping production and walking out. Women are seeing that the only way to stop attacks and murders of women at the hands of Islamofascists is to organize and defend themselves. Students are seeing that to prevent the rising suicide among them due to economic hardship is to organize and fight back. Farmers who burn their crops due to low-cost imports, shop owners who shutter their windows, and healthcare workers lining up at unprecedented levels to leave the country are seeing that the only way to defend themselves is to resist. Lawyers being beaten, tortured, and thrown out of court by cops are given a life and death fight. Peasants are protecting their forests against foreign mining interests who poison their waters with arsenic stage actions for the first time. Unless these fights, these resistances come together, jointly fighting back and organize against fascism, no election or voting will change the doomed fate of the people under this regime. The tiny opening following the elections may provide opportunities for a joint struggle. The people's will to live with dignity and not hunger will have a chance to be realized only through the heightening of resistance on the streets for a different system outside of capitalism. Elections were just the first step, and it was won. Now, the task returns to doing the actual work to organize the street resistance. This is Mehmet Bayram, reporting for Capitalism, Race and Democracy. Sarmaşık güllere dolaştım, öptüm sevdim, halelleştim, öptüm sevdim, halelleştim. Yanıyorum, yanıyorum, yanıyorum hele, mail olur onca güne.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, J.R. Valray, Akua Holt, Mehmet Bayram, Ann Garrison, and Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.